Hi, I'm Carmen LaBerge. Here's the podcast for Connecting Faith. Enjoy the conversation.
Real conversations about how we live out our faith every day. Welcome to Connecting Faith.
Hey friends, welcome to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. Always a pleasure to gather with you here. If you want to visit us online, the website is myfaithradio.com. There are additional resources posted for you there. You can also visit my ministry website, which is reconnectwithcarmen.com. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Carmen LaBerge. All right, so what we try to do here on the Reconnect is reconnect the eternal with the everyday. We try to take the headline news of the day, bring the mind of Christ to bear, understand the world in which we live, and then engage with it winsomely and effectively as the ambassadors of the kingdom of heaven, right here in the midst of the kingdoms of this earth. So let's jump in. So the headline that I'm bringing us today is from just a handful of days ago, and it's some research by Pew. So if you're familiar with Pew Research, you know that we're talking about reputable statistics here, reputable research, and this is posted by Jonathan Evans. And the headline is this: U.S. adults are more religious than Western Europeans. You might say to yourself, when I read that headline, Carmen, don't we already know that Western Europe is sort of more secular than the United States of America? Like, don't we already, like, is this gonna, research going to surprise anybody? Well, frankly, here was the surprise in it for me. It's how people actually understand these terms. And so what this research is bearing out is that people in Western Europe who describe themselves as religious are actually more secular than people in America who describe themselves as secular. So secularists in the United States of America are still more religious than people in Western Europe who identify as religious. So I know that's a little bit confusing, and I want to unpack it, and there's a reason for this. So when we talk about how people describe themselves, it's actually, you know, there's a fairly religious makeup in terms of Christianity, fairly religious makeup in both Western Europe and the United States. And those numbers have been falling off in Western Europe faster, at a faster rate than here in the United States. So in Europe, there are more religiously unaffiliated people than in, let's say, the United Kingdom or other Western European countries. And so where we have a quarter of American adults now identifying as nuns, that has been true in Germany and the UK and Western Europe for some period of time. We have now just sort of caught up with those particular numbers. And so at that point, we say, well, then maybe there's no story here at all. If a quarter of Americans and roughly a quarter of Western Europeans all describe themselves as religiously unaffiliated, then where's the story in this? Well, even those religiously unaffiliated people here in the United States are still, they're still religious in ways that people in Western Europe are not, even the religious people in Western Europe. And so I find that very interesting. When we talk about the practices of people here in the United States and the practices of people in Western Europe, that's really where the evidence lies. So here in the United States, you might have a person who describes themselves as secular only because they're not officially affiliated with any particular organized religious group. And yet, if you ask them if they believe in God, an overwhelming majority of them say yes. In Western Europe, however, even among the percentage of people who still identify as religiously affiliated, they continue to recognize themselves as a part of some organized religion. An overwhelming majority of them do not believe in God, in terms of a God who knows all things, in terms of a God who is sovereign over human history, and certainly not the God who we know through the scriptures of the Old and New Testaments. And so where 20% of religious nuns in the United States, people who describe themselves as atheist, agnostic, or nothing in particular, believe in God with absolute certainty. Now think about that for just a second. 27% of the people in the United States who say that they are either atheist, agnostic, or nothing in particular, they still believe in God with what they describe as absolute certainty. Christians in Western Europe do not describe themselves as believing in God with absolute certainty. So And in terms of worship attendance, you know, same kind of thing. Or how about daily prayer? This is the one that really stands out to me. Because certainly prayer would be, I would say, a measure of religious commitment, of actually recognizing that you're in a relationship with a real God who actually really cares and has real influence in human history. So the fact that only 6% of Christians, just think about that for a second. These are people in the United Kingdom who identify as Christians. Only 6% of them say they pray daily. I don't know what kind of religious commitment you have if only 6% of the people who are supposedly Christian are actually praying. Now, the religiously unaffiliated here in America, they're actually twice as likely to believe in God with absolute certainty as people who describe themselves as religious or Christian in Germany. So German Christians have a lower rate of absolute certainty about the existence of God than do unaffiliated or non-religious Americans. Okay, to talk with us about what it's like to be a Christian in Europe and to advocate for religious liberty there, my next guest works with the Alliance Defending Freedom International, and that's next up. You're listening to Connecting Faith, and I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. Welcome back to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. I am privileged to be joined today by Andreas Tonhauser. Welcome to Connecting Faith. You are working with ADF International. So tell us what the Alliance Defending Freedom International is.
Well, thank you for having me, and it's a great pleasure to be here. ADF International is a Christian human rights organization advocating for the right to people to freely live out their faith, especially at international courts and international institutions throughout the world.
So, Andreas, we hear here in the United States, we hear about human rights violations that break our hearts and horrify our sensibilities in relationship to the way people have been brutalized and victimized, and when we know them because they have refugee stories and they have these trauma stories. But in Europe and in Western Europe, there are some things going on that may be running beneath the radar of most Americans as well. So I would love for you to tell us why a Christian organization birthed here in the United States related to religious liberty and freedom now exists internationally. Like, what's the motivation? And then the kinds of issues that you all are dealing with.
Well, thank you very much for this question. Yes, I think so I'm based in Vienna in the heart of Europe, and I've joined ADF International 3 years ago because I have five children myself, and getting to know the way Alliance Defending Freedom works in the U.S. and what ADF International now is building up in a global model, so to say, is exactly what we need in Europe, exactly what we need when it comes to Christian values. I want my children to live and to have the same rights to freedom of speech, freedom of religion, freedom of conscience, like I'm enjoying right now. And I just see those freedoms being under attack, under fierce attack, actually. And if you know a little bit about Europe, you also know that it's very diverse. It's not the same in all the different countries. But what we experienced and why it was necessary also to start an international branch of Alliance Defending Freedom is that we have started to live in a very small world. Think of social media, think of air travel, think of the media in general. Today, it's one idea sparks out in one specific place, but then it really travels the world. And what we see that people, proponents of, let's say, LGBT values, proponents of who stand against life, for example, they work internationally, and they share their models on a global level, and they do strategic they engage strategically on a global level, and very often the Christian side, our side, does is not thinking so much about this and has come to the table at the later stage. We see that at the United Nations where we work, we see that at the European level, at the EU, but also at the Council of Europe, and we see this in Latin America at the OAS, and of course also in Asia where we have a lot of allies. So our model is really to, like in the US, to have allied organizations and allied lawyers and key influencers in the media and in politics around the world to know about persecution and, you know, if you want to really name it, about to know about harassment of Christians, of discrimination of Christians, and persecution in the end, like we face in Asia or parts of Africa right now, and to protect the individual, to help them litigate their cases in front of the courts and to keep them out of jail. Nobody should be arrested because of their faith. Sadly enough, it's a reality that we face every day, but really help them on that individual level, but then promote those stories, make those stories known, share it with the media, but also share it with key stakeholders at the United Nations, with Western governments who give a lot of foreign aid to those countries that are still violating religious freedom, and in order to ultimately prevent it. So not just to fight the symptoms, but really to fight the disease, to get to the core of the issues, and to help prevent persecution altogether. Now, when I say persecution, we always think of a matter of life and death. And we have those kind of cases in Pakistan when it comes to blasphemy cases, where Christians are being accused of having committed blasphemy and face death penalties. But persecution can also be something that's not only a matter of life and death. Like in Europe, we have cases, as you have here in the U.S., of professionals who do not want to choose between their profession and their faith, but who want to live in line with their convictions and at the same time also have a professional career. That is not possible anymore in the medical field. We have cases of Swedish midwives, for example. Together with our allies, we defend them. Now we've brought their case to the European Court of Human Rights. It's an international court because they've lost their case in Sweden. It's Elena Grimmark, for example. She trained to become a midwife at the age of 40. She wanted to help bring life into the world. She's a Christian. And she just let her employer know that if it's possible, she'd rather not participate in abortions because she cannot bring this in line with her faith. She already had the job but then lost it again before even starting to work. And they informed all the clinics around her home that she's a troublemaker, that they should not give her a job. And now she can't find a job in Sweden anymore. And this is something very real. And there are other midwives as well that we're bringing to the Court of Human Rights. It's not as it doesn't have the same power as the Supreme Court in the United States, but it does have jurisdiction over 800 million Europeans in 47 different countries, and this court can say there's a violation of human rights. And for example, Sweden is a member of the court, so they will have to reconsider this case. And that's part of our work, for example. That would be one example. We have other cases in Europe, like here, where it's about bakeries who do not want to produce wedding cakes for same-sex marriages, same-sex weddings, printers who do not want to print LGBT posters, and so on and so forth. And there's also a crackdown on free speech, disguised as anti-terror laws, disguised as hate speech laws. But this is what we're facing in Europe right now. And interestingly enough, cases like Jack Phillips are being quoted by Supreme Courts in European countries. Just happened so with a Polish printer case, a printer who didn't want to print LGBT posters. The case of Jack Phillips was quoted in the final judgment. And the same is true of ECHR cases or Inter-American Court cases that are being quoted also in U.S. legislations. Hmm. So it has become a smaller world, and we need to start building those bridges again, especially on the more conservative spectrum of society, where we say we want to be able to live freely according to our values, according to our faith and what we believe in, and we need to work together in order to achieve that.
So one of the observations as a total newbie to the reality of ADF International has been how instantaneous the rapport is with one another, because it's not as if we're trying to, you know, build some kind of strategic alliance with people who differ radically. It's actually people who are so incredibly similar in terms of value system and the basis of how we understand the universe, and how we understand human life and how we understand marriage and how we understand the responsibility of parents to raise children. Like, they're such basic, there's so many basic things upon which to build conversations. And so as you're listening, friends, to Connecting Faith today, let me just remind you, I'm talking with Andreas Tannhauser, and he is with ADF International. And I know that you think about the Alliance Defending Freedom here in the United States, but ADF now has this international network of attorneys and staff members who help tell the stories, help bring the stories to us, help us understand what's happening with our brothers and sisters in Christ around the world. And I have been, I think, really excited to learn about some of the specific cases that you guys are working on. So, Andreas, I'm wondering if you'll just share some of those stories with us.
One thing that we regret a little bit is that we see that there's still sometimes a gap between the U.S. and Europe, and especially also between like-minded people, between Christians, where it's not very plain to see, but still, it's I think we have to learn even more to share, to pray together, to pray for each other, and to stand up for what we believe is right, also. And one good example of this, where it's sort of it's never a one-way street, right? So a good example of this is the case of euthanasia. We have done extensive work in Belgium and the Netherlands on cases of euthanasia. We have one big case at the European Court of Human Rights. Tom Moitier, who has also been featured in media here in the U.S., he lost his mother due to euthanasia. She had psychological problems, found a doctor who was a big proponent of euthanasia laws in Belgium, and one day Tom Moitier gets a call from the hospital saying, "You can pick up the stuff of your mother." He didn't know what was going on. They euthanized her the day before without even consulting the family, without asking anybody if it's okay, and this wonderful lady was gone and going through a deep depression, probably wouldn't have even had the intention, but just met the wrong person, really. And so he sued the government, and he sued the doctor doing this, and lost in all instances in Belgium. Now, Tucker Carlson of Fox News got hold of the story and heard about this and heard about what is going on in Belgium, and we documented it very well, the white papers on the situation there and how euthanasia laws tend to be a slippery slope, that, you know, you once open the gate, you can never close it again. And it started out with only talking about people who, you know, haven't really done anything for the last 2 or 3 years and are just suffering. But coming from 15 people in the first year to more than 2,000 now.
And now children.
And allowing child euthanasia, and it's spreading, right? And I know in the U.S. it's being discussed in many different states and debated also to allow it on state levels, and in some states it is allowed already. So we did this interview with Fox News, just sharing the statistics that we have on euthanasia and what happened in Belgium, where it's been legal since 2004, just to show that this is a path you don't want to go down, because it's really, really now it's you know, the as they call it, the freedom to die becomes an obligation to die. People are feeling pressured. The society just grows cold, and to warn countries of this development, that's what we're doing in Europe, and we've seen victories in this. Many countries like Portugal and other countries that have considered it have stepped down from it, have stepped back, and parliaments have said, no, we don't want that. But only after they've been confronted with the stories and the facts of what is happening if you allow that, and if you go down that, it's really the culture of death And so this is something that we were able to share also with U.S. audiences, and we got a lot of feedback, which we're very happy to do so.
So, Andreas, I want to spend a lot of time in the next segment talking about the I'm Human Right. I'm Human Right. I love that it's phrased as a question. The website is imhumanright.org. I want to spend a lot of time in the next segment talking about that. I'm wondering if you can give us a quick update on Latin America. I know that recently the Argentines have been considering widening the scope of opportunity in relationship to abortion. Can you just sort of tell us where things stand with that?
Right now I can report you, and very gladly so, that we've seen a big victory for life in Argentina. Just very, very recently, we've been very concerned with the way all of Latin America is heading right now. There's a huge international pressure from lobby groups, from governments, from international multilateral organizations like the OAS on the Latin American countries to introduce abortion laws that do not respect life at all, to introduce laws that go against the family, all kinds of family values. And Argentina has been sort of the latest target of these groups, where the president himself asked the lower house, what it's called there, the parliament, to produce a bill or to draft a bill that would allow abortion on demand, basically even allowing abortion until birth.
Yeah, it was very wide.
It was so wide that like even psychological problems of the mother would be reason enough to allow for it. Now, how do you define that really? So it's really abortion on demand till the latest day. And even with a clause more or less forcing doctors, nurses, medical staff in general to participate in abortion if they do not want to face prosecution and punishment. And right now they had, and they will continue to have, a very good law which is only in very narrow circumstances allowing for abortion. For example, if the mother has been raped or if there's severe risks to
mm-hmm.
life for the mother. But the Senate discussed it. It was the last stage, and everybody already feared that the Senate would pass this. And our senior counsel in Latin America, Nady Casillas, who is working extensively with governments and legislative bodies in Latin America as an expert lawyer on international law, could brief the Senate and could make it very clear that there's no right to abortion in international law, because that was one of the kind of assumptions that have been made by the legislative bodies there before. There's no right to abortion, and that actually the bill, if it would have been passed, it would have violated international law because it disrespected conscientious objection of medical staff. So this is a huge win, something that we're very grateful for, because we've seen a lot of Latin American countries also falter on some of these issues.
All right, friends, that voice that you are hearing is Andreas Tannhauser. He is with ADF International. And we got to take a quick break, but when we come back, Andreas and I are going to continue this conversation. And specifically, we're going to talk about a campaign of ADF International that asks the question, I'm human, right? And it is at imhumanright.org. You're listening to Connecting Faith. I'm Carmen LaBerge.
My God's not dead. He's surely alive. He's living on the inside.
Hey, friends. Welcome back to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge, joined today by Andreas Tannhauser. He is with ADF International. Again, Andreas, welcome to Connecting Faith.
Well, thank you for having me.
So let's jump into the conversation about the campaign called I'm Right, or I'm Human, Right? I always think I'm right. But I'm Human, Right? Tell us about that.
So this year we see the 70th anniversary of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. It's the main document protecting the right to life, freedom of speech, right to the family, parental rights, and so on. The United Nations Art and Monitoring Body. However, in the last 70 years, sadly so, we've seen that those rights not only have been always respected in the right way. We see persecution of faith groups. We see a lot of disrespect for the right to life, for example, but also in a way been hijacked. And new, we call them faux or fake rights, have been introduced by international groups who claim to be defending human rights but really want to push their agenda. So we take the 70th anniversary of the Declaration of Human Rights and urge all nations to uphold those fundamental rights, especially to life, family, and religious freedom as they were originally intended. Therefore, we drafted a so-called statement. We called it the Geneva Statement, and ask everybody of the same who supports those opinions as well to sign the support. And then we're going to present the support also to the United Nations. We will present it to the international community and ask to do more to live up to what the human rights originally intended.
So I love the emphasis in here on what is universal in a plural world. I love that the way that that's phrased, first of all. We here on the show talk a lot about, you know, one of the essential components of getting anywhere in a conversation with anyone is at the outset to establish your common ground.
Yeah.
And that's what this feels like. It feels like we're establishing what's the common ground upon which we can all agree in terms of the universal human rights of every person everywhere, regardless of the government under which they live or the circumstance of their birth or
exactly.
their particular geography. So from your perspective, what is the most universal, what are the universals in a plural world?
I think the most universal is the inherent dignity of the human being. And if we can't agree on this anymore, then we'll be back to a time before civilization, right? Because then if human beings or states or governments get to define who a human being is and who is not, and we've seen this in the last century. I'm from Austria in Europe, so we experienced this ourselves with the Nazis coming in who wanted to define who gets to be a human being and who not. If we do not defend this fundamental right, the inherent dignity of the human being, the right to life, the right to speak freely, the right to think freely, the right to conscience, and the right to faith, of course, then we have lost as a civilization. And today, due to relativism and other ideologies that are really front and center in this international debate, there's a big risk of losing sight of what the Universal Declaration really achieved, namely to, as you said, to find a common ground that we can all agree on, regardless of our cultural backgrounds and regardless of even our faith backgrounds. But especially as Christians, we think it is very, very important to enforce those rights, because we see today, and the religious, that the Christians are the biggest faith group suffering under persecution today, is how essential it is to have those rights protected.
So, friends, you can check it out at imhumanright.org, and you can actually, there's a place to sign on to the statement and stand with others who are engaged and involved in raising their voice with others to be co-signers on the Geneva Statement. If you're a person familiar with the Manhattan Declaration here in the U.S. a number of years ago, this would be a statement upon which you could find common cause. You're going to read this. You're going to resonate with it. You're going to say, "Oh yeah, I get that. I resonate with that." This is sort of globalizing the conversation that we've been having here in the United States and among conservative Christians in particular, but really seeking to say that, you know, these ideas that we have about what it means to be human, these aren't just our ideas. These are actually universal truths. And so encouraging on the 70th anniversary of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights for those human rights to be reaffirmed, this is what this is seeking to do. So I invite your participation in it. The website is I'm Human Right. You can ask it as a question or you can state it. I'm Human Right.org. Andreas, I want to ask you to describe to people what life is like as a Christian dad of five kids in Vienna, because people listening, you know, we've talked about what you're doing, and we've talked about the motivation, but I think that it would help them to, you know, go home with you for a minute. So just tell us what is life like.
Well, living in Vienna is a great thing. It's really a good place to live because it's very safe. It's there's beauty of nature and there's a big history.
It's a big city.
Million people.
Like, do you have to give us the whole story, because most of us have been so focused on the United States of America that we wouldn't even really probably be able to easily find Austria on a map.
Yeah.
Let's just confess it.
So, no, I'm happy to do that. It's in the heart of Europe. So if you look at the map, just go to the middle of Europe. That's where we are. And we're next to the River Danube. You might know the famous music piece, the Danube Waltz. That's where we live, and there's a lot of history and a lot of tradition in Vienna, and raising a family there is very it's a very good life. It's easy to have a good life, you know, even with five children, because there's support from the employers and government also for families. However, having five children is something
unusual.
It's out of the ordinary. Absolutely. Most people have one or two children, like almost everywhere in the Western world nowadays. It's not that there is, you know, that you're being frowned upon just because you have more children, but it's definitely something that that people kind of eye as, at the worst, strange, and at the best, unusual.
Some eyebrow raising. When five kids here, we're like, hey, he's got five kids. When you say you've got five kids and you're with your colleagues from across Europe, there might be some eyebrow raising.
Oh, there might be eyebrow raising. No, definitely, yes. At the same time, it's so unusual already that people, if you take a stand and don't feel embarrassed about it, but just say, no, that's who I am, that's what I do, and it's great fun to have a big family. Then there's interest again, because people they are so much focused also, and I guess it's not so much different than the US, so much focused on their jobs, their careers, and their everyday life and their hamster's wheel, that you know, seeing something that is unusual and still something that is attractive in a way, because we're human beings, we're made for family, right? Everywhere around the world, that's the core of society. So it's also appealing in a way. That's what we see. We're completely out of the ordinary. We're also homeschooling, which is almost unheard of in Austria. In Germany, it's a crime.
I was going to say so legal, because we know of we covered the story of the German family you know, they're not allowed to homeschool their kids. Now, there's going to be people listening right now who are going to be stunned by that. That we take things for granted here in the United States that I think we don't recognize have not always been appreciated, even here. And so tell us, like, what does that look like for you to homeschool in an environment where nobody else is really doing that?
You have to have a thick skin. You have to be very intentional about it. And you have to be prepared to face, you know, people questioning what you're doing, to also stand up to the government. We never had problems, I have to say. So for us, it was always quite easy to do it. But I know of many families, also American families, expats living in Vienna, who do not speak German so well because there's no need to for them, who have a lot of difficulties taking their exams. They're not allowed to follow English curricula and so on. So there is, it's not all free. It's much better than Germany, of course. So we have a lot of refugees from Germany coming to Austria because they want to homeschool their kids. But it's far from ideal, and we also see a crackdown on this again because it's, of course, goes against governmental control, right? At the same time, people are also inspired by it because they see our educational system is getting, especially in Vienna with a lot of immigration, it's not handled well. So it's also kind of shining a little bit of a light. There are other solutions. You just have to dare. You know, you don't always have to live your life in a way like everybody else is doing it. And of course, faith helps us tremendously. Because that's where we see we only have 70 to 80 years. We have to make them count. We want to give our kids the best that we can. And homeschooling is, for our family, one of the ways to do that.
Tell us about your experience of church.
So Austria is a Catholic country. It's always been Catholic for a very, very, very long time. And it's, you know, there's a separation between religion and state, and it's been there for a long time. But still, it's been kind of the state religion in a way. And people have been secularized the last decade, and also with the catastrophes that we were facing, World War II, those kind of things, the atrocities that have been committed, it's something that really also is weighing down on the faith and on a relationship of a whole peoples with God, right? So we do experience this. At the same time, we see a renewal. We see really a the Holy Spirit working in the country, where a lot of new groups are, you know, inspired also by churches in the U.S., by preachers in the U.S., by the 24/7 prayer initiatives and those kind of things. They're present in Austria too. As I said, it's a small world, right? We are listening to podcasts of Rick Warren and other preachers in the U.S.
And I'm sure you'll now be listening to the Connecting Faith podcast. I'm just kidding.
Absolutely. I'm sorry to name
names. We love Rick Warren. No, it's good. It's good.
And no, but just as an example, and there are many more. So this is happening also in Austria, and that's also a good thing for the country itself, because at the same time, what we also have in Austria is secularism, is relativism, is you know, kids who don't have a concept of a healthy family anymore. We have a high divorce rate and a low birth rate. So those are all things that we're facing, and we have a lot of immigration being confronted with very faithful people of other religions that all of a sudden we can't counter to because we're so secularist that, you know, we don't understand religion anymore.
So if folks want to follow up on the Geneva Statement, they go to imhumanright.org. If they want to see more stories about what's happening with ADF International, where do they go online?
Very simple, adfinternational.org. Please check it out. It's we always try to update it. You will read a lot about our cases internationally.
I just love it. Andreas Taunhauser, thank you so much for being with us here today on Connecting Faith.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a great pleasure.
Hey friends, stay with me. I got to take one more quick break, and then we'll be back to make the connecting point. I'm Carmen LaBerge. You're listening to Connecting Faith. Friends, welcome back to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. Let's spend a little time today making the connecting point. So I thought it would be kind of fun, after my conversation with Andreas, to actually explore some of the theology surrounding what people in Western Europe believe. And so I very recently read a tweet, and I know you're saying to yourself, okay, now she's bringing us stuff from Twitter. Well, sometimes Twitter takes me interesting places. And so I got a tweet inviting me to play a game, which I did not play, but it invited me to play a game which would then identify which Norse god I am. And so it's actually called Which Norse God Are You? It's not a very creative name for a game, I don't suppose. But apparently Thor and his fellow Norse gods not only have a lot of ancient theology, they have a lot of people today who identify with them. And so there are a number of ways online that that people can identify which Norse god they are. Now, it's actually framed that way. It's framed as if you and I are gods,
which Norse god, not which Norse god are you most like, or which Norse god with which Norse god do you, you know, share a lot of attributes. But no, this is like literally, which Norse god are you? And so I think that when we talk about entering the conversations of the day, sometimes the conversations that are going on online, sometimes the conversations that are going on in the field of play, in terms of gameplay out there, most of us are not spending any time there at all. And so we're not even aware of the myths that people are believing, not only about deities, but the myths people are then believing about themselves. So let's talk for a minute about Norse mythology. Norse mythology is this body of myths of the, the Germanic tribes from the north. So, you know, they all grow out of Norse paganism. And after the Christianization of Scandinavia, these Norse myths, these mythical gods, actually continued to be woven into much of the Christianity, even of these northern countries. And so the northernmost extension of sort of the Germanic mythology is Norse mythology. And there are values of or tales and traits of these various deities and heroes that get derived from lots of different sources, both before and after what we would recognize as sort of the pagan period. You can read these in all kinds of medieval manuscripts and throughout folk tradition. And they've made a massive comeback. I mean, certainly when we think today about, when we think about Wonder Woman, when we think about the other characters who are considered to be real heroes, other than Superman, when you take Aquaman and when you take Thor, when you begin considering where these mythological heroes came from, you are right in the middle of Norse mythology. And so, even Loki is, that's a Norse god. And so I think that you can enter into the conversations of our day by entering into the conversations that have been going on for a really long time. And those are largely pagan conversations. And so what do we know about paganism? Why should it matter to us that people not only believe in the existence of other gods, but actually, when I say worship them, they certainly glorify them. Maybe it doesn't go all the way to worship, but there's a lot of glory given today to what we would consider as the modern day representations of Norse mythological gods. And so, maybe we should spend some time thinking about that. Maybe we should spend some time thinking about what the Norse gods have to say about the afterlife, what the Norse gods have to say about love, what the Norse gods have to say about pleasure, what the Norse gods have to say about power. And so when you're watching movies today, and when you are reading contemporary blogs and other fodder that features these godlike people, that's the only way to describe it, because they all have human characteristics, and yet they are more than human. They have transcended what it means to be human in one way, shape, or form, but they are not the image bearers of Almighty God. So they are not human beings. They are something beyond that or other than that. And that's a good place for us to pause and have a conversation as well. Like, what does God, the real God, the God of everything, the creator of all things, what does God have to say about these competing deities? What does he have to say about the very idea that we would mess around with, that we would synchronize our faith with any kind of false worship? And now you're saying to yourself, oh, Carmen, this is just fun. Like, we're just doing this for fun. And Wonder Woman, she's wonderful. And I like Thor. And, you know, don't you feel a little sorry for him? And when you're talking about the other DC comic characters and what Warner Brothers is doing, and, you know, I'm sort of recognize that I'm messing around with well, modern day Avengers. I mean, you know, right? I mean, that's sort of what we're talking about. And so I think that we have to recognize what we're worshiping and why we're worshiping it. And it's okay. I mean, I'm not here to say that, you know, you can't go watch the Wonder Woman movie. I mean, you know, we watch it. But I am here to say we have to help our kids make the distinction between gods that are made up and the God who's not made up, the God who made all things, the God who made up everything else, right? So in terms of who we are, you're not a Norse god. And even if you go online and you play the game that helps you identify which Norse god you are, you're still not a Norse god. You are an image bearer of the one true God. God is not made in our image. We are made in his. And male and female, he created us. And that's worth talking about. He made us fearfully and wonderfully. He knit us together in our mother's wombs. It's worth turning to the first chapter of the Gospel of John. It's certainly worth turning to 1 John 3:1, which talks about who we are as the children of God. And what a great and miraculous blessing it is to be called that. So if you want to, you know, identify who you are in terms of a relationship with God, you are not a god or a goddess, but you are an image bearer of God. You are a child of God. You are a citizen of the kingdom of God. You are an ambassador of that same kingdom. Your physical body is a vessel in which the Holy Spirit of the living God is pleased to dwell. Again, that doesn't make you God. But it does hold the possibility of your life being conformed by one degree of glory to another, more into the likeness of Christ, who is God, fully human and fully God. So we're not gods, but we belong to God. We are God's possession. And when we talk about the attributes of God and the characteristics of God, we talk about the harmony of the attributes of God being bound up in the concept of grace. And then we understand ourselves to be conduits of God's grace to the world that he so loves. We're not saying that we are God. We're saying that, isn't it really cool that God chooses to use us? Isn't it really cool that there's a human agency to the way God is working out his will in the world today? So being like God has always been, I think, you know, a great temptation. It was the temptation of Adam and Eve in the garden, right? To be like God in knowing not only good, because they already knew good, but in knowing evil. Like, why would you even want that? But they did, because they wanted to be like God. And obviously God knew everything. And so God, you know, knew not only good, but God knew evil. And so they wanted to eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. They already had all the knowledge of good. But there's such a temptation to have it all and be it all and be like God. I think about Lucifer wanting to be like God. Look at all the trouble that got Lucifer into. And look at all the trouble that Lucifer has now gotten so many people into. And the world itself. Such trouble. How about in Genesis 11, when we talk about the people in the town of Babel? What did they want to do? They wanted to make a name for themselves. They wanted to be like God. They wanted to build a tower that everybody could see. And so in reality, this has been a great temptation for a very, very long time. And so I think it's a conversation that we can get into today. It's a conversation that humanity has been in for a very, very long time. I think that when people began to imagine that there must be gods, and gods must be like people, we get confused about who God is. But we have the answers to all of that. And you and I can actually speak truth into these cultural conversations of our day by knowing God through his word in the Old and New Testaments of Scripture. All right, friends, that is about all the time we've got here today on Connecting Faith. You can visit us online at myfaithradio.com. You can also visit my ministry website at reconnectwithcarmen.com. I want you to have a great day. and God bless. Thanks for listening to this conversation from Connecting Faith. These podcasts are available because of listener support. You can make a gift now at myfaithradio.com. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend to grow the impact of Connecting Faith. Also, take a moment to subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player and never miss a conversation.